Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Another horrific massacre in another school, this time in Texas.
It's just impossible to express how big of a tragedy this is.
What is to be done, if anything?
How does a nation move forward to try to never let something like this happen again?
Plus, I try to set Brett Seaman straight. The Supreme Court's draft decision on Dobbs is the right one.
If, in fact, this decision comes down substantially the way Alito has written it on a 5-4, 6-3 vote, the abortion argument is going to continue. In fact, I think it's going to make our politics more vicious.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com and follow me on Twitter at Hugh Hewitt. And follow this program as well at Town Hall Review. We begin with another horrific massacre, this time in Uvalde, Texas. 18, 19 children, the death toll may have gone higher. Two teachers. It was a shootout with a mentally disturbed 18-year-old. Mike Gallagher, Congressman extraordinaire from Wisconsin, was a guest on my program. To me, it seems obvious that if you use your spending clause authority, you can give the money necessary to harden schools and have armed response at every school, and I'm trying to focus on a specific problem, and you could require red flag laws. What do you expect is going to happen? What do we do?
Well, first of all, I mean, it's just impossible to express how big of a tragedy this is. I mean, as you mentioned, if you're a parent, I mean, this is the absolute nightmare scenario. And one thing that worries me, and I think it's happening to Kristen Sinema right now, is that anyone in public office who is simply expressing the horror in hearing this news, or saying they want to pray for the families. If they're not immediately going to, we're going to do X, Y, Z, they're getting attacked online. And I think that's really problematic, because we need to take time to understand the specifics of this case, whether the extent of the mental health issues that this individual had, and it seems like there was a well-established history of concerning behavior that went unaddressed. So that's an area where I feel like there is more we can do to address growing mental health problems, as well as to ascertain what gun laws he violated before suggesting that another gun law would have prevented this crisis. And I think one thing that often gets ignored in a lot of cases like this is that we do not enforce existing gun laws right now.
Right, the New York red flag law failed in the Buffalo Killers case.
Exactly. I just spent a half a day with the NYPD on Monday, and I asked them, what are your top concerns right now? And in addition to continuing to have their guard up with threats from terrorist groups and domestic extremists, they're very concerned about the flow of guns. And one of the biggest issues is straw man purchases. We don't do a good job of cracking down on straw man purchases in this country. So
I don't know what that means, Congressman. What's that?
Essentially, someone buys a gun legally, but then gives it to someone else.
Okay.
Which is illegal. And that's something we can absolutely get at today without passing another gun law. So all I'm saying is let's dig into the details of this horrific case, and let's ascertain specifically what failed in the system and what could have been done to prevent this. And then let's have a thoughtful policy response, as opposed to immediately going to demonizing someone just because you disagree with their political views.
I agree with that, too.
There
are four things that stand out: Columbine and Parkland, Newton, and now Uvalde. The Buffalo shooter is a white supremacist at a random soft target. It's impossible to harden every target in America, but protecting innocent children in their classrooms, those who don't even know how to respond, I mean, they're too young. That seems to me to be the problem set, and it seemed to me that the federal government spent $6.8 trillion last year. If it costs $45 billion a year to harden schools, meaning armed officers, the spending clause is available to you guys, provided that the local, I don't want to pass a federal law telling you who to hire. I don't want another TSA. But you can offer to every school district the money necessary to hire those two officers for every school.
I think there's a way where we can harness recently retired professional law enforcement or even certain veterans in order to supplement school resource officers right now. And I think there's a big community of people in those categories that would love that mission post-retirement.
You know, that's a normal person's response, which is the problem is elementary schools and high schools. That's our specific problem. The answer is security. And the other problem is mentally disturbed individuals getting a hold of guns. And this individual, if the early reports is correct, is very disturbed. Everybody in town knew it. On his 18th birthday, he bought two weapons capable of mass slaughter, and nobody said a word. And I also think that is a problem. I think that is a major problem in America's gun laws. And I don't know what the Texas law is. I don't know if you violate any gun laws. But when I see Steve Kerr storming out, that doesn't do anything. In fact, it makes it worse because I get calls from Second Amendment advocates saying this is the thin edge of the wedge. If they pass a red flag law or a stop order law, like Doug Ducey promoted, they'll be after my handgun next. And that's not a very good argument. And you're not a lawyer. You're a PhD. But strict scrutiny under Heller, if it is strict scrutiny, would not allow that. And I just try and tell people that, but you can't talk about this issue without both of the extremes coming at you like you're trying to take away their weapons or you're in favor of slaughter.
Exactly. And how does that bring you closer to any productive solution? If your opening salvo, whether you're Steve Kerr or I don't know, Senator Murphy or whoever, is, oh, Republicans are complicit in the violence, which is just a crazy and reprehensible suggestion, then how are you actually going to have a discussion and figure out where, you know, state or federal laws need to be tweaked or figure out how to, you know, surge more resources to protecting schools? We actually had a bill. Republicans introduced legislation like it's called the MVP Act in the past, which Democrats rejected, which would have taken concrete steps to protect people's rights while ensuring people that shouldn't have weapons don't get them. I mean, for example, it modified criminal penalties for an offense involving the theft of a firearm from a federal firearms licensee. It directed the Department of Justice to take specific actions to prevent gun violence, such as establishing a mass violence prevention center at DOJ, which would serve as the primary government organization for analyzing and integrating all government intelligence pertaining to threats of mass violence. Also enhanced the number of assistant U.S. attorneys that we would need to implement things like Project Safe Neighborhoods, which is the national initiative to reduce gun violence in the United States. So I think there are ways that you can get at this problem without stoking concerns about infringing on people's Second Amendment rights. But again, if the opening part of the discussion is, you know, you're evil, you're complicit in the violence, I just don't know how we get to that productive discussion.
Good luck to you with your colleagues across the aisle. I know some of them are going to go right to their corner and start punching Republicans. And I also know that some Second Amendment absolutists are going to resist the idea of anything. But I do believe there's lots of middle ground, Congressman. Lots of middle ground. Salem's Mike Gallagher asks how our nation moves forward, trying to make sure nothing like this happens again.
How does a nation move forward to try to never let something like this happen again? And for Uvalde, Texas, this is a catastrophe. It's a human catastrophe. Things like this shouldn't occur, but it happens. And it strikes me that we are looking at the collision course of two immovable objects, two sides of a debate that unfortunately won't budge. Our side says it's a people problem. It's a personnel problem. We don't have the sufficient personnel. Kind of simple to me. We ought to have as much diligence about protecting our children as we do our banks. If you go into a bank and you see an armed guard, why in the world would we think that the bank deserves more protection than our precious children? If your mindset is that we have too many guns already, the very last thing you're going to want to talk about is having armed personnel to protect our precious children. We should be a country in mourning. We should be a country in grief. We should be a country that resolves to figure this out. We may never really get to a sufficient answer, but all of those dead babies in Uvalde, Texas, demand that we try. The anger is real, and we all ought to be angry. The problem is the anger doesn't just get to be reserved for those on the left. And there's a lot of anger on the left. Here's Senator Chris Murphy.
But I'm here on this floor to beg, to literally get down on my hands and knees and beg my colleagues. Find a path forward here. Work with us to find a way to pass laws that make this less likely. I understand my Republican colleagues will not agree to everything that I may support, but there is a common denominator that we can find. There is a place where we can achieve agreement that may not guarantee that America never, ever again sees a mass shooting, that may not overnight cut in half the number of murders that happen in America. It will not solve the problem of American violence by itself. But by doing something, we at least stop sending this quiet message of endorsement to these killers whose brains are breaking, who see the highest levels of government doing nothing.
All right, so let's dive into that. Let's pick that apart. Do something. Do something. What something would you start with? Go ahead, tell us. What something would that be? And that's a realistic, pragmatic, not unreasonable thing to ask. What something would that be?
Coming up, the draft of the Supreme Court's decision.
If, in fact, this decision comes down substantially the way Alito has written it on a 5-4, 6-3 vote, the abortion argument is going to continue. In fact, I think it's going to make our politics more vicious.
My conversation with New York Times columnist Brett Stevens when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
Grounded in our distinctive Great Books curriculum, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy prepares students for exciting careers in politics who understand the relevance of America's founding principles to today's policy challenges. From our Southern California campus, we've sent over 1,000 alumni across America and around the world. The application period for fall 2022 classes has begun. Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. When the rogue clerk leaked the Supreme Court draft decision in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health early this month, I think it was a clerk, we don't know yet, the nation got a sneak peek into how the court was thinking. Alito's draft is superb. If that becomes the final opinion, it gets the Supreme Court out of an arena that it ought never to have entered, which it did with Roe. It should not have done so in the first place. Brett Stevens, formerly with Wall Street Journal, now a columnist for the New York Times, disagrees with me. He was a guest on my program. We'll pick up with Brett making a point about the court's Citizens United decision from 2010.
This is my core argument, particularly when a decision like Roe or Casey has advanced to a huge class of people a right that they have enjoyed and taken for granted for generations. That, I think, is something that deserves more consideration than the question of whether corporations should be treated as enjoying First Amendment rights.
Well, this is where we fundamentally disagree. They have not taken it for granted. As you have seen, the abortion debate is never ending. And it will never end because it concerns first principles on the status of the unborn child. And I don't think anyone argues that it's not a child in the ninth month. A lot of people argue that early term abortions in the first month don't make a difference. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I don't believe there's any way a court is going to strike down, because of the Commerce Clause, the FDA's decision to license the morning after pill. And there's no way that the court is going to wade into the California constitutional framework When they are done with it, they're going to be done with it. And here is the key argument why I think yours is the radical position, not the conservative position. The abortion jurisprudence continues to distort and pervert our law in other areas, especially with regards to free speech, especially with regards to First Amendment rights. And Justice Scalia used to say, unless until we get rid of the idea that a majority vote of 9 unelected people makes the law in the United States, we are in a world of hurt. That's a paraphrase. And we're going to see that again. And it's just never going to stop because it's a religious matter. And unless you trust the people of the states, or you get 60 votes to pass the radical law that Chuck Schumer wanted to pass, we are just postponing and continuing the fraying of the national conversation.
Look, in some sense, I agree with you, Hugh, which is to say that if, in fact, this decision comes down substantially the way Alito has written it on a 5-4, 6-3 vote, the abortion argument is going to continue. In fact, I think it's going to make our politics more vicious. I think it is going to degrade the integrity of the court. This leak of the decision, which I rue and condemn, and I think is a horror, along with protests outside of the homes of justices, are going to become that much more intense. And that's why I say to you, Hugh, this is going to be the domestic policy equivalent of American troops in Baghdad, which is going to be something we will regret in later years. I guess that I think that the expression is Pyrrhic victory.
And what I say to you, if we're going to use that analogy, eventually you have to withdraw from a field that is contested. You don't want to withdraw like we withdrew in Afghanistan, unannounced, without anyone knowing and without any kind of security for those on one side. But the court, to save the court, has to get out of this forest, Brett. I've been trying to make this argument for 25 years. I'm not making a life begins at conception argument. I'm making a Federalist 78 argument. It's the weakest branch. It needs to restore its credibility. This is why, by the way, I think the Chief Justice assigned it to Alito and will concur and will point to his concurrence in Citizens United about stare decisis.
By the way, in that respect, I suspect that you're right about Roberts's vote. This is not going to end this. It's not going to end it at the court level. The 6-3 conservative majority won't last forever, and this battle will never end. We had something like a settled consensus in the United States. Abortions were actually going down in this country, which is I think everyone would agree is a good thing. This is just going to be another upheaval in a world already riven with upheavals.
And we disagree about how to get to peace, though we both want to get to peace. Let me close with this. I don't know if you focused on Justice Alito's comment that the standard that will replace the scrutiny of Casey will be the rational basis test. I believe that the court will strike down any complete ban on abortion that prohibits early term abortion. I believe they will count that as irrational and that it is not in keeping. And there are a bunch of precedents like City of Claiborne and other places where rational basis doesn't mean that legislatures get a free pass. If radical laws are passed, especially any law punishing a woman getting an abortion, those laws will be struck down.
Why?
Because they are irrational in the way that Claiborne.
Why shouldn't the court? Here's the weakness of your argument. Why shouldn't the court leave that to the states to decide?
Because the rational basis test has been articulated for much longer than 50 years and goes back indeed to the beginning of strict scrutiny, which is when something so offends so much of the country, the court will rise up and strike it down, as they have done repeatedly under rational basis. And I do believe there is an enormous 90% plus consensus in America to leave this to the states. I believe it is a supermajority position to leave it to the states, but I also believe it's a supermajority position that if you attempt to ban abortion in the first month or the day after pill, the morning after pill, the court will reflect that consensus under a rational basis review. If I'm right, Brett, does that ease your mind about where we're heading, which is to stasis with women on notice and men on notice that any mistake they make with regard to pregnancy should be remedied early if they think it's a mistake?
You've just made my argument for me, and you've essentially wrested the future of abortion and, in fact, of other reproductive freedoms in the hands of states who may be much less liberal-minded than even you are, Hugh.
I am completely at ease with that because I believe, as Churchill did, trust the people. And if the Federalists, not just 78, but anything, can be understood in their entirety, it comes down to we have dual sovereignty and we will trust the people of the United States when they act according
to
their...
But one last point. The entire Constitution of the United States, the entire structure of government, checks and balances the existence of a Supreme Court. John Marshall's jurisprudence is all about not entirely trusting the people.
It is about not entirely trusting the people on the limited and enumerated powers that have been delegated to the Congress. And when we get, when we break out of that constitutional construct, when we take away the right of states to control the dual sovereignty that was created in 1789 and ratified by the people, not by the states, we risk becoming one government, which is the nightmare. Then it becomes the opportunity, the invitation to authoritarianism, which so many people worried about, Brett. We've got to stick with the Constitution.
Thank goodness for the 14th Amendment, which made us more one government and less a federal system in which particular states could pass laws that vitiated the fundamental rights of large portions of their citizens.
And Brett, last phrase. Section 5 of the 14th Amendment provides the Congress with the United States with the authority to enact laws to further its purposes. If and when there is a supermajority to do that in the Senate, because I know you're in favor of the filibuster as I am, then I'm going to shut up because the 14th Amendment is very much a part of the Constitution, as is Section 5, and that allows for the sorts of laws that Chuck Schumer tried to get passed and could not even get a majority, including members of his own party, to support. We are not a radical country on this issue. We are a leave people alone country, but protect children in the womb when they have become indeed unarguably children.
Yes, and at the rate that this court is working, Chuck Schumer might just get that majority.
Go to townhallreview.com to hear all of my conversation with Brett Stevens. Coming up.
There's a tendency now to be very bold about changing the Constitution.
Victor Davis Hanson when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
Hi, it's Mike Gallagher. I start every day by reading through the stories at Daybreak Insider. It's a look at today's most compelling stories and provides responses from key conservatives in media and politics. Over 250,000 people get Daybreak Insider by email daily, and it's available to you at no cost. Go to daybreakinsider.com and simply plug in your email. That's daybreakinsider.com. In 5 minutes, you will be the most informed person in the office. That's daybreakinsider.com.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Victor Davis Hanson is a historian who wrote a book late last year titled The Dying Citizen, How Progressive Elites, Tribalism, and Globalization Are Destroying the Idea of America. Watching events unfold today, the book is more relevant than ever. VDH spoke with Salem host Charlie Kirk.
Tell us about your book, The Dying Citizen.
It's not a lamentation or a eulogy for the dead citizen, because I would have called it the dead citizen. It's a process of dying, and it's an erosion in the traditional prerogatives of a citizen. I think it applies to the Western world in general, not just the United States in particular, but it's the suggestion that there's no sharp difference between a resident, legal or illegal, and a citizen, whether that means voting today or engaging in a campaign. You can be a resident. You can be here illegally and do that. Or military service. The only distinction that's left really is the ability to hold office. Only citizens can do that. But if you're not a citizen, you're a resident. You can come and go as you please, apparently. We're seeing the southern border. You can join the military. You can vote in certain places. I think soon you'll be able to hold office. So I tried to explain the history of citizenship. It was very rare, peculiar, late in history in the 8th century in Greece, fragile today. There's only two or three places that can pull off a multiracial constitutional system, Brazil, maybe India, and they don't do it very well. So I was trying to remind people that unless you invest in citizenship and constantly audit it, it's the aberration in history and it will disappear. I think it is disappearing unless we stand at attention and try to do something to save it.
What is necessary to revive citizenship?
Well, I try to say we have to reverse the organic pressures on it. And one of them is, of course, the erosion of the middle class. If you don't have a middle class, then you have a subsidized poor and a very small, powerful, influential, rich elite. That's kind of California's the model of that. And then you need definable, secure borders. You can't have, you can't be citizens of the world. You have to be citizens of a unique place. And we don't have a secure southern border. And you can't revert to a pre-civilizational tribalism where you start, where your identity is your race. Let's put it this way. Your race or your ethnic background or pedigree is essential to who you are, not incidental. And then the elites on the other side, this administrative state of legislative, executive, and judicial powers within an unelected bureaucrat, a James Comey, a Lois Lerner. It's very dangerous, as we've seen, especially. It's growing, especially the media, big government, permanent employee fusion, whether we that's defined by MSNBC, CNN, James Clapper, John Brennan type of fusion. And there's a tendency now to be very bold about changing the Constitution, whether that's packing, ending the Electoral College or the state's superiority or prerogative of making national voting laws, or even the customs and traditions of, say, a nine-person court or a 50-state union. These have been there for decades, 60 years for the states, all for short-term political expediency. So in larger historical terms, it's more the Athenian model we're grabbing to, that everybody gets to vote on any given day, on anything, and that has the force of law without constitutional guide rails. And then finally, we're becoming citizens of the world, where our elites on the East Coast feel they're more, have more affinities with the culture and values of the EU, and people on the West Coast feel that economically, financially, they're more tied to Asia than they are the United States. You can really see it. If you ask somebody at Stanford or Berkeley or Caltech, what's a restaurant like in Bakersfield or Fresno, they have no idea, even though it's 200 miles away. You ask them about where to eat in Shanghai or, you know, Taipei or Tokyo, they can tell you. So the people who have real power in this country look outward rather than inward.
I'm going to ask you about motivations, like what motivates the current regime, if you can call it that, to try to crush citizenship or citizens. What do you think?
The most dangerous people feel that they're doing it for others. In other words, they don't see themselves as self-interested. Mm. If you talk to Bill Gates or Klaus Schwab or Mark Zuckerberg, why did you put $419 million into selected precincts to warp or absorb the duties of the registrar in key precincts? They say, I'm doing it to preserve democracy. And by that is, they feel that they, being this globalized elite, that they are morally superior, they're better educated, even though a lot of them are not, but they have a sense of their guardians, and they just need enough power. If they just give them enough power, they can create heaven on earth.
Coming up,
they're delighted that gas is $7 a gallon.
More from Victor Davis Hanson when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
Grounded in our distinctive Great Books curriculum, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy prepares students for exciting careers in politics who understand the relevance of America's founding principles to today's policy challenges. From our Southern California campus, we've sent over 1,000 alumni across America and around the world. The application period for fall 2022 classes has begun. Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. In the previous segment, Victor Davis Hanson discussed his book, The Dying Citizen, and how the left has become increasingly bold in their disdain for the values that make America great. How far will they go? Here's more of VDH conversation with Salem's Charlie Kirk.
These people, for all of their brotherhood of man talk, are absolute cutthroats as far as the acquisition and maintenance of power. They really want it. You can really see it with the Bidens. I mean, they were so worried that their agenda wasn't palatable to people that they put Joe Biden in as a thin veneer of a very radical agenda that they know had no support. And they thought, you know, it's good old Joe Biden from Scranton. We know he's cognitively impaired. He'll get us across the finish line. He'll be presentable. And then we can open the border, or we can have critical race theory, critical legal theory, or defund the all of that agenda, which they know has no public support, but they feel it's good for us. So they're delighted that gas is $7 a gallon. But you get the impression that they're not entirely angry, except for the optics of long gas lines in a midterm election year. Even then, though, I think, you know, the Germans have kind of renounced their green insanity, but Biden couldn't. We still shut down Anwar and no new federal leases and Keystone.
So they've convinced themselves they're doing the right thing, their ideology. The yeah. path of progress, regardless of what's happening around them,
they're not empirical. If you say to Joe Biden and the people around him, the world is short of oil, and the people who are making money off that shortage are illiberal regimes in the Middle East, Vladimir Putin, the Venezuelans, and the Iranians. So why don't you just enrich the Alaskans and the North Dakotans and the Texans? Why don't you do that rather than fill the coffers of Putin or the theocracy in Iran? And they would say, well, we're not going to do that because their power is based on the money from the green base, and they're ideologues. So ideologues are immune from empiricism. No matter what you say, it's not going to halt, subvert, impair, change, modify, adapt the mission. The mission is to get all of us onto green power, renewable energy, live in high rises, have mass transit, and have a few platonic guardians who are exempt from the ramifications of their own ideology. So Barack Obama can lecture us on greed. He can lecture us that we've got to treat each other, and then he can build three mansions, Martha's Vineyard, Colorama, and Hawaii. Sees no inconsistency because John Kerry needs that private jet and that huge carbon footprint so he can help us. That's how they think. You just give them enough power and they will create heaven on earth.
So that's really interesting to me. And I want to unpack that for some of our listeners that might not be as familiar with some of the academic arguments there, where you said ideologues are immune to empiricism or empirical interpretation.
Yes.
Where does that come from? That's really interesting to me.
Well, it comes in part from the Enlightenment, and that's defined from the Greek 5th century, Socrates. You know, he said, I'm a citizen of the world, and, you know, it's a good thing a lot to explain. If you see an eclipse, you don't say Zeus did it or Apollo did it. You try to scientific method. The problem with it is that when you take it to an extreme, you can't explain. I can't explain why you may go to the airport today and be fine, and I go to the airport and get in an accident. There's God. There's faith. There's an element within our experience.
Of mystery, sure.
It's mystery, and that requires faith. So they don't believe in that. In their arrogance, they think they can explain everything. And so, but there's a natural imprint in our soul to want to believe in something that's transcendent. So what they do, since they've ruled out God or religion, they have that religious natural zeal, and they worship reason. I mean, in the French Revolution, they had a god, you know, the god reason, Ratio, and they had a statue of him. They renamed the days of the week. They renamed the
10-day calendar. Yeah.
Yeah, everything. Mm-hmm. So that's what the green woke movement is. These people are zealots. They feel we are so rational that we can tell you that if you listen to us and we will get racial relations so they're perfect. If you just allow us to tell you how to drive and where to live. But caveat, for us to do all that and sacrifice on your behalf, we need certain exemptions.
That's really interesting. And I would think somewhat confusing to our audience because they say, okay, if they believe they're rooted in hyper reason, then how do they explain that men can become pregnant and I can't define what a woman is? Like, does that make sense? It just seems so inconsistent if that's...
Well, the distinction is to remember that they say they believe in reason.
That's
like
important.
All humans, they have religious propensities. The only problem is, the irony is that, say, a devout Christian realizes that brain surgery will remove the tumor, not necessarily faith healing. And they go to a... But if they're a Christian brain surgeon, they cannot tell the person, well, when you're getting in the ambulance, I don't know why it ran out of gas and you died. They leave that element of mystery, but not these people. Their religion is this sense of enlightenment. They can explain everything. And when they can't explain everything, it doesn't matter to them. So you have the nominee to the Supreme Court, and she says that there are three genders. Well, that's a faith-based analysis. There's something, an ancient idea of gender dysphoria, where a person is in the wrong biological body, and we've had names for it, transsexuals, transvestism, the idea you want to wear clothes of the opposite. And that's been dealt with medicine for 2,500 years. But this new idea that you can construct your gender and be any gender you wish to be or you think you must be, that's not biologically proven. So we have this Supreme Court nominee and says, well, I'm not a biologist, as if she can't explain it because it's inexplicable. It's a faith-based statement. She needs to say what she needed to say if she was intellectually honest is, I'm not a biologist who could explain it, because a disinterested biologist would say that there is a biological male and female, and there's a small category that have neurological incompatibility with their, but that's very small. But what she's really saying is, I need a minister of transgendered faith, and they could come in here and tell you why you must believe this to save your soul.
Coming up, while the red states value freedom,
and the other half, the blue half, they despise those places.
The final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt when we return.
Hi, I'm Don Crow. This week in the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, a special look at the life and impact and the enduring attraction of C.S. Lewis. It's been over half a century since he died.
Probably more people read Lewis now than ever before.
We'll hear from his stepson on the story behind Mere Christianity, born in the context of World War II.
Talking to young men who were going out to die, to give them some form of hope that was not final, some understanding of God himself.
And the earlier war that shaped both him and J.R.R. Tolkien.
And then they go on to write these epic tales of heroism where war is at the center of the thing.
You won't want to miss our special edition of The Christian Outlook.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. It is a simple fact that no nation can last forever. And when we look at our nation, a world without America as the leading superpower is something we really don't want to think about for ourselves, for our children, especially for our grandchildren. But there are plenty who worry that our own future is teetering on disaster. Increasingly, many Americans don't fear losing to a foreign enemy, but rather losing our freedom bit by bit from within. Until it's gone forever. Could America really fall? Charlie Kirk and Victor Davis Hanson continued this conversation.
Countries have a tendency to fall apart and yes. Fracture. They usually don't all fall as one whole, especially big countries. They usually get smaller. Mm-hmm. Is that in the cards for America? Because a wide-ranging republic was a very ambitious idea.
It was. I mean, there's periods of regeneration. We had this conversation in Rome, 68 AD, and we looked at what Nero, and then the year of the, we would say it's over with. And then all of a sudden the Flavians come, just Vespasian, and we get a great picture. And then it starts to get a little weird with Domitian, and then we think, oh, it's back. And then all of a sudden we have what Gibbon called the finest period in human history, 100 years of the 5 year. And then it goes
Aurelius and then yes. Commodus. And then
we get these cycles and they keep coming back. The problem with the United States is that whenever you have a geographical multiplier of ideology.
What do you mean by that?
Okay, you have a slave issue in 1820 to 1860, but the slave issue is not, here's a problem with slavery in Michigan, here's a problem in the East Coast. It's right down the Mason-Dixon
line.
Sure, yeah. 60s, you have culture. You got guys wearing beads, you know, saying blank, blank, the establishment all over the United States. This time, because of these major existential issues, globalization has changed the economy, this weird worship of a BA degree, that hollowing out of the interior, this cosmopolitan worship of Europe, whatever we term it, it's starting to be geographical.
That's interesting. You're right. Yeah,
I can go along in San Jose or Palo Alto, Berkeley, I can go from La Jolla to Seattle, and I do a lot. And the coffee shops are the same. The peoples are the same.
Their attitudes are the same.
I can go, drive 20 miles into 50 miles into the interior in Oregon or go to Fresno or Bakersfield, Inland Empire. Same thing with the East Coast. I can go to upstate New York, and it's like a different world. And so people are starting to self-select. And these red states and red state areas within blue states, they work. And it's starting to be enclaves of resistance. And it's half the country. And the other half, the blue half, they despise those places.
For the entire Kirk VDH conversation, go to townhallreview.com. Thank you for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Pray for the people of Texas. Pray for the people of Buffalo. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin and producers David Pouchon, Michael Cook, Alex Perez, Tim Gantner, Adam Ramsey, Jacob Orduña, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.